Podtacular, the unofficial Halo Universe podcast, presents episode 618, Legacy of Onyx, recorded live on March 1st, 2018. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Podtacular, the unofficial Halo Universe podcast. I am your host, Duststorm.
And I'm your co-host, Godzilla T.
We're diving into another book for this podcast. Missed February by a day, but I finally got around to reading another book, which is unheard of. Hopefully to change that this year.
So Dust did get his homework done.
I did get my homework done. Granted, it was a week later than we originally planned, but I did get it done nonetheless. Yay! And some other homework I got done too is I finished the main campaign story of Halo Wars 2 on Legendary with Bobby.
Well, that's good.
He will still likely be able to stream Operation Spearbreaker this coming weekend, so I hope to stream that with him on Legendary as well. After that, might not have the internet to do a co-stream, but hopefully this weekend we'll go through Operation Spearbreaker. And then that leaves us with the Banished campaign.
Which ought to be just a blast.
I'm not looking forward to that one. I think the other two campaigns are relatively easy compared to that one.
What? You think just because of the Flood?
It seems like they ramped up the difficulty a little bit.
Ah.
in that campaign. I think
you're just seeing things.
Well, if I'm seeing things, I hope I'm seeing them for the right reason. Because they're scary. We'll be getting into that, hopefully, stream-wise, in a couple weeks. That might be after the wedding, depending on how everything falls as far as scheduling goes, because that's coming up here pretty soon. Speaking of which, this setup will only be here for another 2 weeks after today. So, only two more podcasts after this one. And then I will be in a completely new location. I will no longer be at 117. Womp womp.
Have to give up the Master Chief's address.
Yeah. That's okay. Moving on to better things. It was fun while it lasted. Yes, Haas, I am going to the chapel. Well, not exactly a chapel, but I'm going to get married too. Yay! We have a lot to discuss for Legacy of Onyx. There's also a intro section from Halo Fractures called Lessons Learned that was also written by Matt Forbeck that we'll get into a little bit as well. But first, we have a couple of news things to go through. First one is Mega Constructs at the New York Toy Fair 2018. Mega Blocks, or I guess Mega Constructs, Mattel showed off some more figures at the event. The latest Halo Heroes series, which is up to 8 now, which is crazy. I don't even think I've seen 7 in stores yet, but they did showcase the new Series 8. It's going to be Master Chief in the classic Mark V armor, Dr. Halsey, Spartan Emil, Spartan Centurion, Spartan Recruit, and a Jackal Miner. Ooh. All Series 8 stuff. The Master Chief in the original Mark V, that one's going to be cool. Emil, I think, is going to be a fan favorite as well, just because of his role in Reach.
Yeah.
Then Halsey, I think, is going to be another nice touch.
I think Halsey's going to turn out to be firecracker ammo.
I can see why.
I could see Halsey with an M80 strapped to her back.
Oh, man. Didn't even think about that, but you're probably right. So that's the latest Halo Heroes set. There are 4 other sets that they revealed as well. They revealed the Banished Marauder Strike, UNSC Blizzard Squad, which is another one of those Marine squads. There's a Forge Hog versus Banished Goliath. And then there's also the UNSC Frost Raven versus Decimus. So all 4 new sets and the new Halo Heroes series line that was revealed at the New York Toy Fair this year. That's your little view into the Halo gear side of things. Next up is the Spring Arena 2018 season has finally kicked off. So for everyone who was wondering when they were going to start a new arena season, it has begun. So ranks have reset. It's time to go get your ranked levels in for the spring season. So I guess instead of doing it bi-monthly now, they're doing it every quarter or every season.
Yeah, I got 5 games in tonight.
When was the last time they changed it over? Was it at the beginning of the year or was it sometime last year?
Honestly, don't remember.
It's been a while.
Yeah.
An unusually long while, I think. I don't remember.
Yeah, if they're going to do them once a quarter, then...
They just wound down, I guess, enough to not do it so frequently. I guess it kind of makes sense to do it alongside the Halo World Halo Championship Series seasons.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's what they're doing, and that just kind of rounds out to be every quarter anyways. That's a possibility.
It is.
So yeah, heading on over to the arena, get your ranks in, and start off the new season with a bang. I have to go in and see what the emblem was for this past season.
I opened my pack and now I can't remember what it was. Isn't that sad?
I guess I'll go over to my pack real quick. Go through the website and pull it up. But yeah, next little thing while I pull that up. The Steven Spielberg Halo TV miniseries, as it's being called now, may start filming in the fall.
Ooh. Info.
I know. Actually, something substantial for a change. I know we talked about, was it 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, the IMDb page.
Every year there's been at the beginning of the year saying, yes, we're still working on it. Yes, we're still working on it. But we actually have something that they might start working on it. If that makes sense, I don't know. I'm guessing, based off of the article, it's an article that was posted by Pursue News. Just based on how it's written, it seems like it's kind of going off of the potential success of Ready Player One, which, just looking at the trailer, it seems like this is going to be the first video game-based movie, even though I think Ready Player One is based off of the book, but it's within the realm of video games that's going to be successful.
I've been watching the trailers for it, and I could have swore I saw Spartans in there.
Oh, there were definitely Spartans in there. There's no question about that. There are definitely Spartans in there, which I'm hoping is going to be one of the catalysts, I guess, to actually getting this project off the ground.
Hopefully.
All right, I am into my Rex on Waypoint, and that is very disappointing. For the season, there was not an emblem.
Oh, there wasn't?
All I got was boosts. All I got was boosts.
Well, that bites.
That really sucks. I guess they ran out of content. They finally ran out of content to give us an Halo 5. All right, Forgers, it's up to you. Yeah, all boosts. That's kind of sad. Time for Halo 6.
Because I'm real sure I haven't unlocked all the emblems.
Well, some of them are still locked behind the levels and commendations. The Spartan ranks, if you haven't gotten up to a certain point, I think you get one usually at every 10 levels. So there's ones locked behind there, and then there are some that are locked behind commendations as well. So you'd have to be really going for completion on all of that stuff to get every emblem. Just a thought. So I did not know this, but in the article it mentions that Steven Spielberg was actually the one that directed Ready Player One. And since he's doing the Halo TV show, it seems like that he's finally cleared up his directing abilities to focus on the Halo TV series. So that might be another reason why. If Ready Player One was in the development stages for as long as it seems like it could have been, I might be able to give a slide of, okay, you worked on something that's probably really cool, probably a good foray actually into making a quality video game movie. So it might be some room for slack. That's just kind of my opinion of it. Also, this past weekend was the London finals. So the EU had their regional finals, and we have the top 4 teams that have been taking the first seeds of the Halo World Championship finals that will be taking place in Seattle. They are Team Infused, Vexed, Fable Esports from France, and Maestro. So they got the top four top four seeds, and then Team Infused was the one that actually took home the gold and then $10,000 for the London finals. This coming weekend is going to be Australia. So that'll be the Australia and New Zealand as well. But we actually have something arranged to kind of do a little recap of the London finals this past week. So I'm going to shoot it over to our special guest via pre-recorded audio, and we'll check out what he has to say.
What's up, everybody? Tazman here from the Bad at Halo show with a recap of the EU Region HCS World Championship qualifier that just took place this past weekend. So let's spawn in and get this thing started.
Set, start.
32 teams descended upon Gfinity Esports Arena in London, England, all competing for their share of $25,000 prize pool, and more importantly, one of four qualifying spots for World Finals at CenturyLink Field in April to compete for $1 million. Day one went with very little drama, as each first round bracket game featured 3-0 sweeps, with the exception of one series going the five-game distance between Salient and Aerox Esports, with Aerox taking the win and their reward facing the number two-seeded Vexed eBuyer Gaming. From this point on, the top six teams completely took over and left the rest of the EU in the dust. Team Infused, arguably the best Halo team in the EU, featuring Jimbo, Kimbo, Moe's, and Respectful, stormed all the way to the Winners Bracket Finals without dropping a single map, and became the first team to qualify for Halo Worlds in Seattle. Vexed eBuyer Gaming forged their own undefeated path, with Riots, Lunny, Snipedrone, and Quadios, and were crushing everyone until they ran into another top four team, Fable Esports, in the quarterfinals. Fable's team of Frenchmen SLG and Fragger, teaming with Cristola and Snakey, almost became the Cinderella story of the tournament, coming within 3 points on Eden Slayer of winning the match, the series, and punching their ticket to finals over the higher seeded Vexed. However, it wasn't meant to be, as Vexed stormed back, took the victory from the jaws of defeat, and stamped the series home in the following Slayer match to set up a Championship Sunday Winners Bracket Final between the top two teams in the EU. Number 4 seed Mistro Gaming, featuring 2Foxy, Flux Ramirez, fighting to get their teammate Batchford into his first Halo 5 World Finals, were a buzzsaw of their own, slicing through the field with 3-0 sweeps of their own, until they ran into the immovable object of Team Infused, losing in a 3-0 sweep of their own, and would need to win their Losers Bracket match to qualify for Finals. Mistro would come up first, going up against Polaris Gaming of Hollers, Slumpy, Key6, and Shiesty. Polaris made quite the story themselves, even coming up with a huge 3-1 upset over favored Skitlight earlier in the tournament. Unfortunately, Infused would send them to the loser's bracket, and after 3-1 and 3-2 loser bracket victories, they seemed to run out of steam against Mistro as they took the 3-0 win, a guaranteed top 4 finish, and a trip to Seattle in April. It then came down to either a story of redemption or collapse for the boys of Fable. They found themselves playing against Mockit of Warlord, Looney, Squashy, and Outcast. Mockit was looking for redemption themselves, as Fable had been the team to put them into the loser's bracket after a 3-0 quarterfinals loss. Mockit would rebound with a huge 3-1 victory over Skitlight, and a 3-0 sweep of Endpoint, featuring previous Halo World participants Buck20, Zuh, and Morga, to set their sights for revenge on Fable. However, it wasn't meant to be, as Fable repeated their earlier performance with a second 3-0 sweep over Mockit and the fourth and final Worlds spot, and a chance at a potentially higher seed and better Worlds group placement in the Losers Bracket semifinal against Mistro. Moving on to Championship Sunday, Vexed eBuyer Gaming came out strong with a 3-2 capture the flag win on Truth and jumped to a massive 15 kill lead on Plaza Slayer, but the number one team in the EU would not be denied, and once they got their rhythm, they went on a massive comeback, clawing their way to a 50-46 victory. The rest of the games in this series saw Vexed put themselves in opportunities to take away wins and potentially the series, but they just couldn't close the games late, leaving the door open for Infused, and Infused stepped through every time and slammed the door in Vexed's collective face and took the series 4-1 and sent themselves to the grand finals. In the loser bracket semifinals, Fable Esports and Mistro Gaming, the elimination bracket semifinal between these two teams was a giant game of Halo 5 Tug of War. Both teams traded points, kills, and probably had the longest game of Coliseum Capture the Flag with a massive 7-plus minute flag standoff. But after all the back and forth, the push and the pull, and trading wins, it was Fable that came out on top 4-2, guaranteed a top 3 spot and a chance at revenge with Vexed E-Buyer. Unfortunately for Fable, second verse, same as the first, with one less win this time around. Vexed wasn't about to relive the winner's bracket quarters nightmare they received from Fable a second time around. Except for a restart Kali Slayer, Vexed took control over every other game, dominating Fable at every turn. They won the series 4-1, guaranteed a top 2, and got their own chance at redemption from Infused. Gfinity London was not the place for redemption stories. Infused, perhaps aware that they were close on numerous occasions to multiple losses and potential series loss, never let Vexed get out of the gate. They took each game in dominating fashion, Truth Slayer being the only close game, but Infused wins in a 4-0 sweep, take home $10,000 of the $25,000 prize pool, and the best possible group placement for the EU region at World Finals. So that's it for the first regional finals of the HCS Worlds 2018 season. Congratulations to Mistro Gaming, Fable Esports, Vexed E-Buyer Gaming, and Team Infused for being the first teams to qualify for finals in Seattle. Our next LAN will be March 9th to 11th, with the best teams in the Australia-New Zealand region will battle it out to send 2 representatives to finals. For full preview and detailed post-LAN analysis of each LAN tournament, be sure to join me on the Bad at Halo show every Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern live on Mixer, Twitch, and YouTube, or you can check out the audio podcast through Apple Podcasts and Google Play. With that, guys, my Spartan is dead, and I'll catch you on my next respawn. Until then, back to Dust Storm and the Ed McMahon to his Johnny Carson, Godzilla T.
Thanks, Tazman, for putting that together. We were talking to him a little bit, and I actually got a hold of him last week to do that little kind of teaser for us. He's opted to do it for us every week, so up until the World Finals. So make sure you go on over to his podcast, Bad at Halo Show. Like he said, he records live on Sunday nights at 9 p.m., and then he also has an audio podcast, which you can find on iTunes. And I'm sure there's a couple other podcast aggregation services out there that you can find it. So definitely go check him out. He also has a Discord as well. So you can check him out in his Discord channel as well. I actually got to play with him last week, right after we were done with the podcast. I actually hopped on with him for probably about an hour or so of games. And we had a lot of fun.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to have to talk to him about the Johnny Carson thing. I don't know.
No, not a fan. I thought it was funny.
Oh, it's funny.
We will be anticipating him for next week when he'll do the Australian recap. And then I believe the week after that is going straight towards Mexico for the Latin American finals. Then the week after that, or maybe 2 weeks after that, is going to be the U.S. finals. So we got quite a bit of Halo WC action coming down the pipeline. Again, thanks to Tazman for putting that together for us. It'll sound a lot better in edit than it does during the live show, but hopefully next week it'll be a little bit more of a clean cut, because hopefully I'll be over fully to OBS by then and not using XSplit for the live stream anymore. We will see. All right, it is the time that everyone has been waiting for. It is time to talk about some Halo novels.
Yay!
Yes. We have a little bit of a prelude going into Legacy of Onyx. Similar to the last book we did, there is a Fracture story that kind of preludes Legacy of Onyx, which will go over and discuss a little bit. It is Lessons Learned. It is the very first story in the Halo Fractures set of stories, also done by Matt Forbeck. And I have determined after reading New Blood and Legacy of Onyx and a couple of other shorts that Matt Forbeck does a really good job of being able to write stories that you can easily relate to, and it kind of draws out that human relational emotional side of the Halo universe, of the Halo lore.
Especially this latest book.
Yeah, I tweeted him before the show saying that I would put this book up in my favorites alongside the original trilogy and Ghosts of Onyx. It was that good, to me at least.
Yeah, don't get me wrong, it is a great book. It was not what I expected, but we'll get into that as we go through the book.
Yeah, it wasn't quite what I expected either. But I just
especially with this lead-in story.
It did kind of throw you off a little bit, but I was pleasantly surprised by what Legacy of Onyx had to offer. So yeah, let's just jump into Lessons Learned. We are... is this a space station that they're on? I couldn't quite figure out. Okay. So Tom and Lucy on their space station. You may remember Tom and Lucy from Legacy or Ghosts of Onyx.
They were
in the beta company of the Spartan 3 program. Lucy was the one that during Project Torpedo didn't exactly lose her voice, but was so traumatized by the event that she lost her ability to speak. So there's no... She doesn't speak until at some point during... Was it during Glasslands or Thursday War? Probably during Glasslands.
Yeah, I think it's late in Glasslands.
I think it's at the end of Glasslands because it's right before they make it out of the Dyson Sphere and right after Halsey gets taken in by Perrin Goski, I think. And I actually know this because I've been listening to the Halo Conversationalists, and the last two podcasts I listened to were Glasslands and Thursday War. So it was kind of a nice little prelude to all this too, because this kind of just flows right in line with the Karen Travis novels. Granted, I haven't read Mortal Dictata yet, so there's a gap in there. But it fit really well in with what we're going to be talking about tonight. Lucy got her voice back when she was yelling at Halsey for pressuring a Huragok to basically help her through some tough situations with her trying to get tech out to prove her worth to the rest of Oni and all that fun stuff. But that's another book. We won't get into that too much. But Tom and Lucy, beta company from the Spartan 3s, are introduced to them. They feel an explosion, hear an explosion, trying to figure out what it is. And they run around trying to find out where the explosion happened. And it turns out that all the doors going to the area where it happened have been sealed because it's been depressurized. And they finally get a hold of Captain Chu, trying to get a sit rep on the whole situation. And he mentions that there was a rupture in the rec room and they're trying to figure out who actually committed a homicide. At that time, Lucy looks out the window and says, "Hey, Tom, there's some people fighting outside." And it happens to be two Spartans that are not in suits who they recognize. The first one being Spartan Shane, and the second one being June. Not the same June from Reach. Different June.
No, same June.
Is it the same June?
Yes, it's the same June.
I thought it was different. Okay.
No, it's June from Reach.
So June's alive.
Yes, June lives.
Oh. Is this the first time that they say June's alive after Reach?
There's some external fiction somewhere that says it. I can't remember what it is.
So I guess I'm still missing plot holes. I'm still behind on my reading and I'm missing major plot holes. What the heck?
It's, if I remember right, it's not in a book.
Penn says he was in New Blood.
Oh yeah, that's where it was. He was in New Blood.
I guess because I assumed June was dead in Reach, I never made the connection that June was the same as the Reach June. And neither this one. I guess I should pay attention to the service tax a lot more.
Yes.
Because that would have been a major tip-off.
June recruited Buck. Well, June recruited all the Spartan 4s, if I remember correctly.
Okay. Well, I'm not perfect. I'll just make that be my excuse. I really need to catch up on my reading, don't I? Okay, well, now that we've cleared that up, thankfully, June was the one that went out in the little scuffle. He kicked off Shane into deep space to try to propel himself back to the station. And, of course, being Spartans, Tom and Lucy tried to do some crazy things. And they find a tether at one of the little hallways that they use, and Tom launches himself out to try to catch June. Unfortunately, he shoots way too far, and Lucy kind of figures it out, grabs the tether and starts pulling them back, and he's able to kind of swing around and catch June. By the time he catches June, June's already passed out, and Tom is just doing everything he can to not black out. And eventually they make it back. And it's probably been a few days in the med bay of them recovering, but they made it back, and Tom was welcomed back by Musa, which we've been very familiar with in the past as well. And there's a little backstory into the little scuffle that happened, and basically Spartan Shane just kind of went crazy and turned on them, and apparently there was a murder. Did the book say it was specifically by Shane who caused the murder? I mean, I guess it kind of hinted at it.
Shane was a plant for the insurrectionists.
I missed that. He was working. Okay. But it makes sense.
Spoiler territory here. He was working with Mickey in New Blood.
Oh, great. Not this again.
It basically, the part fracture takes place when Buck is on the space station undergoing training, and, you know, the whole murder mystery thing starts.
Is it the same exact one?
Yes. This is all the same time frame.
Gosh, I completely miss connections in this.
Yeah. You know, the part where this story kind of picks up is where Buck and his team have been moved to secure quarters, and then the station loses pressure.
So it's in and around that whole situation in the book.
Right.
Okay. They apparently, Captain O'Day, June, and Musa cornered Shane and was going to interrogate him, and he popped a grenade, killing...
Actually, more like a grenade belt, but okay.
They said grenade in the... Yeah. And that was what caused the explosion and the rupture, and due to their success in getting June back, Musa decided, hey, it's time for you to get you back in the field. And it turns out they're going back to Onyx, where they trained as little Spartans. Going back home. And they happen to meet someone familiar on Onyx as well.
Oh. None.
Okay. They got to meet up with Mendez, who was the ones that was training them up as Spartans. And he is now chief of security of the Onyx, not the facility, because Onyx is gigantic, but Trevelyan and Paxopolis, the kind of a research colony, I guess, a research city that has been occupied by a whole bunch of Oni and UNSC researchers that are kind of diving into the treasure trove of foreign tech that's at Onyx.
Yeah, this is 5 years after Ghost of Onyx. Or, well, after they're rescued from Onyx.
So basically 5 years after the events of Glasslands. So they meet Mendez. Mendez kind of gives them a little breakdown of what he does. And then they're introduced to Kesha Hilot, who is his second in command, who we'll actually get to meet a little bit later on in the next book as well. And there's a little bit of foreshadowing here, where some of the Marines getting off of the same shuttle that they came in on start throwing some derogatory words towards Kesha. And
Kesha?
Okay.
Kesha.
Thank you. You're the one with audiobooks, so I'll rely on you for all of the correct pronunciation of names.
Not a problem.
But yeah, so a little foreshadowing here with the Marines and Kasha. Eventually, Mendez kind of tells them to get back in the, not the station, but the area where they're, before they disembark to get themselves back off of Onyx. So they basically earned themselves a one-way ticket back off Onyx before they can even really settle in. But yeah, it's kind of a little bit of foreshadowing, and that's kind of where we end up. Granted, we skipped a lot of details, but that's kind of the overarching viewpoint of it.
Yeah, there's not a lot in that short story. It's basically just a primer to Legacy of Onyx. So
let's go ahead and jump on in. We start off with Molly Patel, and this is probably one of the more depressing and not relational is not the word, but
heart-wrenching.
Definitely heart-wrenching, but I guess thoroughly described experience of someone going through what it's like to be glassed. So this whole first chapter is Molly Patel's planet of Paris 4 getting glassed by the Covenant and them trying to get to the evacuation ships and just trying to escape. And yeah, it might make you shed a few tears with everything that's going on. I don't know how much detail we're going to get into this, but basically the Covenant started attacking. They didn't leave right away because they were trying to get a hold of where her sister was at the time, because she was somewhere else. And so they got out late. They started driving towards the spaceport and the space elevator. They weren't able to make it there because there was a bridge that was out. So they turned around, and it turns out there was one of the Covenant ships coming on the glassing beam. So lots of screaming, lots of just crazy going on. And her dad's driving and makes it to a tunnel. But not before they start feeling the actual heat of the glassing beam and windows breaking and shattering. But they're able to make it to the tunnel before they actually get glass. But they're going so fast that they run into the back of a truck. Her parents are instantly dead. And eventually she gets pulled out by none other than Sergeant Johnson. And I like how Johnson kind of made a slight little cameo in here. I have to go back at, maybe you know this, GT, but was there a reference to this event in Contact Harvest?
No, there was not, because this is after Contact Harvest.
I figure it would have been after, I just didn't know if there was maybe a couple of short things afterwards that could have been mentioned.
Not after, before. Or no, wait a minute. No, this would be after, yeah. No, there was no mention of this in Contact Harvest.
Yeah, because Contact Harvest, that would have been the first time that Johnson would have interacted with the Covenant, so it should have been afterwards. Or at least that's what makes sense. I'd have to go back and check the dates. Anyways, so she was adopted by some close family friends, Asha and Young, which she calls her new parents. And to the day of when we're actually kind of starting the book, they're in Aranuka. Is that how you say that? Aranuka. When they first came to Earth, they were living in Wisconsin, and then they moved to Aranuka. From here, she's never really felt like she's fit in. It's kind of a sad story of an orphan that you can't really relate to the things that they've gone through. And at this point, she's 16 years old, so she's just kind of gotten used to it. Eventually, when the Covenant attacked Earth, she thought that she might be able to relate to some of the other families that have gone through similar situations, but it's nothing like what she experienced on Paris 4. So she was always kind of isolated and always kind of looked at as, I think at one point in the book, they said like the girl who lives or something like that. I forget exactly.
Yeah, they, you know, she's
not to pull a Harry Potter reference or something.
Yeah. She's looked upon as,
almost something, like you feel a constant sympathy for her. I forget what phrase they actually used, but it was just something that she always felt isolated. She always felt alone.
She never felt that she fit in, so.
And then eventually they found out that her sister was on one of the
one of the first transports that got blew up.
They got blown out of the sky. Kind of towards the middle to the end of the chapter, her new parents come home. They're actually home early, which kind of puts Molly off a little bit, because last time they came home early, they had some really bad news, which is when she found out her sister actually didn't make it. But it turns out that Young and Asha have been offered a research position on Onyx to study some Forerunner stuff, and they want to move the family again. Molly's reluctant for a couple of reasons. One being that she felt like she's finally kind of getting a foothold and not having to move around so much. Her new parents are trying to convince her that it's going to be the safest place that they can be. There's going to be security that should not be any kind of concern for them. It's kind of run by Oni. It's kind of a classified location, so they can't really talk about it, which it kind of seems like in some of the previous work, they've mentioned some stuff to Molly with her being a kid about some of the work that they do. So she's a little bit more in the know than kind of the average Joe of some of the stuff that the UNSC and Oni's doing out there in the distant stars. But at first she's kind of reluctant. There's not a lot of things going for her, and especially just the prospect of moving again and not wanting to have to kind of pick up and relocate. And I forget, at this point, did they tell her that she's going to be living alongside other aliens? Or was it not until they got there?
They did mention that there would be other races there, yes.
And that really was not going for her either. She did not want any part in that. And I can understand why. Especially given what she went through with the classing of her home. But eventually, she kind of makes the decision to go along with it and kind of pick up and go. I think it was probably, about a week or so that they could kind of let her think it through and just the possibilities of what they could uncover there and working alongside other scientists and researchers from Oni. And the fact that, thank you, Pins, and the fact that there were going to be Spartans there as well, that kind of helped reassure her that going was
Yeah, that's what really turned her around, the chance to meet Spartans. Because, you know, by now they've stated that Molly's dream is to join the UNSC. She wants to help people like Sergeant Johnson.
That's kind of it. So that's where we start getting back to Onyx. Is there anything else you want to touch on before we kind of go move on ahead?
I don't think there's anything.
I mean, it's kind of a pretty much a setup to a lot of the stuff that we're going to see her interacting with the other species in the book. So the other Sanghaili and Ungoy that are going to be on Onyx. This next part kind of picks up where lessons learned picked off or left off. So Tom and Lucy are in the Pelican with Mendez, I think, at the time. And they're actually flying over what we'll later figure out is a Guardian. It's been classified as Project Goliath. And they're flying over, and I think at this point they've already started getting reports of Guardian activation across the galaxy, right? Or is it not quite yet?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, because they deemed Asha and Young's
research
as priority.
And that's why they were saying, hey, we want you to come to Onyx pronto. Because there's some other stuff going on. So yeah, they're flying over. They find this Guardian. So Mendez, I think, has given them the lowdown on what they know about them so far. And that's kind of a very, very quick intro to what's kind of leading up to what Yasha and Young are involved with. The next chapter is them actually hopping on the shuttle and going... Oh, no, sorry. I'm going to rewind a little bit. This is where they actually contact Asha and Young and say, hey, we need you here now, because they actually found a guardian on Onyx. And I think that's when their urgency to leave was a little bit more, because they were like originally just invited, but it wasn't of urgent priority, but now it's been made urgent because they actually found one. Right?
They were recruited to come to Onyx, specifically. Oni, they were already on Oni's payroll. They were relocating Asha and Young to do research on the Guardian directly, which they were already researching the Guardian kind of remotely. They traveled to some other sites to examine Guardians where they could get to them, but they weren't always able to get to them.
For some reason, I thought there was something in here where, like, they were recruited to go to Onyx, but then there was kind of an urgency that kind of bumped them up on the list to go out sooner.
No.
I thought, okay.
No, the urgency was already there. That's why they got...
Gotcha. Eventually, I think we're kind of jumping ahead here, but they get on the shuttle to leave Earth and go to Onyx with the technology that they've already gleaned from Onyx. Their trip to Onyx is significantly reduced from, what was it, days or weeks to hours, something like that?
Pretty much. To the point where they don't have cryo, they have comfy seats.
It was like first class flying at sublight or subspace speeds. And then when they get to Onyx, this was kind of a cool nod to the hard light technology, but when they got to Onyx, they were able to kind of peel away the hull of the ship, and because Mendez was actually communicating to them during the journey, there was kind of like a introduction brief to Onyx and what it was.
Director Barton.
Oh, sorry, Barton.
Which he is the head of the Trevelyan Research Facility.
I'm just going to let you take over. Because you know this better than I do.
Barton was given the... he was given the position over the woman that I cannot remember her name that let Julim Dama escape from Trevelyan, which is a different book.
Yeah, that's Thursday War, I think. Okay. Yeah, I don't remember.
That's where that comes in. But Director Barton, he's the head of the research facility and Trevelyan. He's basically going through kind of an intro speech or presentation for the people that are, well, to the average Joes that are attending or that are on the flight. Like Asha and Young, the higher ups, they got a private briefing that was more detailed.
That's right.
At one point, when they get close to Onyx, yeah, they turn the roof of the ship transparent so that they could see the approach to Onyx and, you know, the scale of what Onyx is. And you know, they're talking about.
They also mentioned that. I think in the general brief, they mentioned that it was contained in subspace, and it was 23 centimeters in diameter. And then once out of subspace, it was 2 astronomical units in diameter, which is freaking huge.
Which is, it's the equivalent to our orbit around our sun.
Times 2. Well, no. 2 astronomical units in diameter, yeah. It's our... If you take the orbit that's around our sun for Earth and then make that into a sphere, that's the sphere of Onyx when it's in real space. And what, the surface area was like, what, 80 billion times the surface area of Earth or something like that?
I think they said you could fit like 100 million Earths on inside the surface or something like that. It's some ungodly large number.
And within the real space of Onyx, you had 3 planets orbiting the fake star. as well, which is also crazy. But yeah, so the hard light technology and basically making the whole transparent to show them Onyx. And it was cool because it's like they opened up the top and it's like, I don't see anything. It was like, yeah, well, look to the side and then you'll see the star field and then you just see
black. Look behind you and then you can see the stars.
Mm-hmm. And then you see black. And then when they got close enough to the shell of Onyx, kind of a proximity sensor showed the kind of blue hard light shield doors that they used to access Onyx. And then they go through that. And it's another couple minute journey through the shell of Onyx. And then they take a nice wide arc over so they can get a good view of the interior of Onyx. And then they land inside.
Which is green. A lot of green.
A lot of green. A lot of mix of Forerunner and UNSC architecture as well. While all this is happening, actually right before this happened, we were introduced to Dural Mdama, who we later find out happens to be one of Jule Mdama's sons. He is one of the last few leaders of the Servants of the Abiding Truth.
No. Jule Mdama was the one that was killed at the beginning of Halo 5.
No, I mean Dural. The Servants of the Abiding Truth, right?
Yeah, Dural took over the Servants of the Abiding Truth after
Telcam.
Yeah, Abumed Telcam was killed by Spartans. Imagine that.
Seems to be a trend going on here. And throughout this book, we actually see matching up timelines where Osiris kills Mdama. We see that come in through a newsfeed. That gets revealed to Dural late in the book, which he kind of takes pretty, not drastically, but it kind of affects him quite a bit at the end of the book.
Well, not as much as you'd think.
Not as much as you think, but it definitely kind of didn't set him off a little bit, but he was kind of taken aback by it.
He was more upset that he didn't get to kill him himself. And he's earned the name Pale Blade because of his pale skin and the fact that he has light blue armor.
And that was taken kind of as an insult for a while, but he actually turned it around and made it a name of honor, especially in his positions, name or a name of respect. So leading up to this story for the Dural side of things, he is on what he's considering a backwater planet, Hesteros, which was used by
Hesteros,
thank you, that we learned in, I think, Thursday War. Maybe it was Glasslands, but who was it? Telcam or Jule used the portal that was there to...
That was Jule Mdama.
Escape from Onyx, and then he came out there. Yeah, so when he was captive at Onyx, I can't remember, again, this is Glasslands of Thursday War, but he was walking around in the fields and there was the engineer with him, and he actually managed to get an upper hand on the engineer. I forget what specifically happened, but it got to where
he tricked the engineer by threatening to damage Forerunner objects or Forerunner buildings by blowing himself up.
So instead of doing that, the Hergok opened the portal, the Hergok disarmed the backpack and then opened the portal, which led to Hesteros. Instead of Westeros, is Hesteros.
Yeah, the way that worked is, oh shoot.
Didn't the engineer just open the portal and then...
Yeah, and disarmed the, disarmed Jule Mdama's belt. Or vest, so that he could escape. And then he escapes to Hesteros, and this is where he hides from the Arbiter and begins to build his covenant.
Dural actually makes it back here because he knows about Onyx and is trying to get there. So there's the Kaidan Panam, is that it? Who was running the keep
Venom, yeah.
At Hesteros. And there's a little exchange back and forth between him and Dural. And it kind of boils down to, well, Phnom says, well, last time, the way Jewel got out was he had an engineer. And Dural's like, well, fortunately enough, we have one too. So we're going to open the portal. And they invade Onyx. Or at least they get to a portal that's a little bit outside of the human population that's on Onyx, or the, I guess, the allies population of Onyx, the ones that play nice together.
They make it to the portal.
I think it's called the Citadel when they get on the inside.
Oh, they make it to the portal that they come out through the portal that Julum Dami uses to escape.
So it's the same one.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then they find that that portal is too small to move their heavier equipment through, you know, like wraiths and
bigger vehicles, banshees,
ghosts, things like that.
Yeah, eventually, I think they look around to try to find another portal that could bring that stuff in, and eventually they find one, right?
They do eventually find one at what they call the Citadel. I forget what the name is that they gave it. It's some ungodly long Sengali name, you know.
Yeah, I wouldn't have bookmarked that or highlighted that. So, but yeah, they eventually get stuff in. They do see the human, what's the word I'm looking for? Encampment, whatever. Words are not coming tonight.
Words are difficult.
I should not cram books whenever we're doing these things, because it just makes talking about them a lot more difficult. The human and the Ungoy and the Sangheili research camp or outpost or city, so to speak, they see that off in the distance. Eventually they plan some attacks against it, but we'll get to that in a little bit. Molly, Asha, and Young are just settling into their new homes when they get some visitors. Mendez and Tom and Lucy come by, along with who will end up being her school teacher, which ends up being a female elite, Kesha. Or Keisha?
Kesha.
I'll write that down.
Like Kaka. Oh.
I'm writing that down phonetically, so don't forget. And at first, she's kind of really taken aback and is it very uncomfortable with the situation. Kesha kind of let her have a room, and she was actually standing outside the house for a while, kind of in the background. But eventually, she gets the courage enough to go over and say hi to her, and she introduces herself as the teacher. And then I think at one point during this, she is kind of sent out of the room because Mendez and the Spartans wanted to talk to Young and Asha specifically about the research that they were working on, and of course she's kind of snooping in on them, so she actually listens to what they're talking about Project Goliath and some of typical the activities teenager. Yeah, typical teenager stuff, and some of the stuff that's going on around the galaxy with the activation of other guardians and how they want to get them to work as quickly as possible. But yeah, she's definitely kind of learning a little bit of what Asha and Young are there to do, and being a little sleepy like that. At one point, she comes down and mentions something. I forget what it was, but she overheard something and then came through the kitchen, like, get a drink of water, and then interjected into the conversation. Do you remember that part at all?
Yeah, I don't remember what she said, but
I'm trying to find it. It is pretty interesting, though, because normally when reading through Halo books, you kind of see it, stories written from the Covenant or like the elite side of things, and then you see it from the UNSC or ONI side of things. This is the first time, I think, in a full novel, because there's been other stories with kids in them, but from a full novel perspective where you actually get one perspective that's dedicated to child's perspective of what's going on.
Well, yeah, child's perspective and civilian's perspective.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You don't pretty much all the perspectives as we see are military's perspectives. That can't talk. You see these from a military point of view, which is you know, it's a much different way to look at things. Seeing the civilian, you know, seeing just the different civilian point of view.
And that's one of the reasons why I really like this book a lot. It just provides a new fresh perspective. And I mean, when you're doing anything from a kid's perspective, and I mean, credit to Matt for it, because he really writes it from their perspective really well. It just kind of gives a whole new light on things, a new way to appreciate what's going on. And of course, it's kind of like the kids that stumble into trouble, but kind of rise to the occasion. So it's your typical, I don't know what kind of story you call that.
Yeah, they don't so much stumble into trouble.
Yeah, they kind of seek it out.
They pretty much go looking for it.
Not all the time, but a fair amount of time. Okay,
once.
Yeah, once the Dural part where they invade and actually attack, that wasn't exactly them stumbling into trouble. Granted, after that started happening, they were looking for it. Because they wanted to help out. She'll make a good soldier.
The one thing I wish is if they'd had those, you know, the two main Sangheili characters, I really wish they'd had their names a little further apart.
Kasha and...
No.
Us?
The two boys. Dural and...
There's Bakam and Gudam. Gudam is the grunt.
Gudam is the grunt. Yeah, the younger Sangheili. I can't... Now Bakam? I can't think of his name.
Or Badam?
Whatever it is, yeah.
Looking. Baran, yeah, there's one that's Baran that's with Dural.
Yeah, it just, yeah.
Bakar. It's Bakar. Yeah, Bakar, yeah. Is the young elite. Who we find out is Dural's brother and also Jules' son, which is kind of crazy. We learn that later on.
Well, there you go, spoiling it again.
Well, I mean, at this point, people have hopefully read the book, so we're just kind of...
Hopefully.
Yeah. I mean, if not, then go listen to Halo...
This whole thing's a spoiler, I know.
Halo Conversationalists haven't gotten to this book yet, but they will soon. At this point, it's one of those things, yeah, we're going to just jump around to the parts that we want to or feel like kind of were interesting to us, I think.
Well, the whole book was interesting.
I mean, there's just a lot of detail in it, which, you know, whenever you cram for an exam, you don't remember all the details. You get some of the higher pictures and you hope to. Yeah, I know. I know. I'm finishing books yet. I'm not fully comprehending them, but at least I'm finishing books. I'm making progress.
You need to learn to absorb what you read.
Well, that's what another read-through is for. I know. This time of my life isn't exactly the best either with the wedding, which is why I'm taking off, I guess technically this month, from cramming a book, which will be nice. I'm still going to try to read another book. I just have to figure out which one.
Dust needs cliff notes.
Yeah. Yes, I do. Especially for these kinds of things. Let's see. Next chapter is back to Dural. It looks like they are about to attack. They have Even Keel, which is their Huragok, open a portal to try to get to the human settlement. Where was it in here where they found another, or they saw humans with another Huragok?
Well, this is where they're attacking their the repository is what they call the building, and basically the humans use it for a hangar / garage type facility. And they find, even Keel finds a Huragok that's working there, which turns out to be prone to drift, which is the first Huragok that made contact with Lucy in Ghost of Onyx, or, well, in the Thursday War.
The one who she accidentally shot his friend. There's lots of cool tie-ins with Ghost of Onyx and with the Karen Travis novels.
Yeah. You know, they didn't just ignore all that previous lore. They used it.
They end up attacking the repository, and they actually cause a... I forget what they called the creature, but there's some big creature.
Rothacrete.
Rothacrete, thank you.
Is what the Sangheili call it. This thing is the size of a house and has, what, 6 legs?
And it has some nasty 9 teeth, which I think they described at one point, like, the mouth is basically 3 feet wide.
It basically...
they can eat up half of a body.
Yeah, it bit a Sangheili in half in one bite.
Pretty scary. But they try to lure one in to cause a distraction, because Dural figures out if they could find a way to distract the humans to lower the guard and actually kind of sneak in to grab the Huragok, that'd be their best option to actually grab it. It happens to be the same day that... I guess we're jumping ahead a little because we didn't even talk about the introduction of these characters, but we'll go back in a second. But the school has a field trip out to the repository. So the kids are actually there when all this commotion goes down. And was it Mendez that was there?
It was Mike Spencer.
Oh, yeah. And he was also in Thursday War.
Uh-huh. He went from being a spy to being a tour director.
Yep. He was the one who was scouting on Naomi's father, who was actually leader of one of the insurrectionist group in the Outer Colonies, right?
Well, he was originally scouting on the Covenant. He was at a listening post on Rains, I think was the name of the planet, which was a glass planet that the Covenant were kind of just scavenging from.
I thought he was also spying on...
Well, later on he was, yes.
Yeah, okay, so it's the same guy.
Later on, he was sent to Venezia to spy on, the insurrectionists.
Our mouths are not working tonight.
That was, shoot. But that's where he comes from.
Yeah, he's given the tour guides, and then all this commotion starts to break out. And this is where the kids start to get into their first little bout of trouble. Actually, no, second bout. First bout is, if we jump back a little bit, Molly doesn't fit in right away at school. There's a couple of kids who she also recognizes at lunch who aren't kind of fitting too well in either. This is where she first meets Kareem and Gudam. So she was walking through the cafeteria. This is probably like one of the first couple, or probably the very first day. And all the tables were full except for two of them. One had Bakar, and he was sitting all by himself. And she didn't want anything to do with an elite, so she saw Kareem and Gudam by themselves at a table. And she figured, well, it's probably better to sit at a table with those two than with the elite. So she sat down with them.
Well, actually, she sat down at a table by herself. She found an open table. And then they came over. Yeah, and then Gudam came over first and scared the wajibbits out of her. Kareem came over first.
Yeah, I thought it was Kareem first and then Gudam, because Kareem kind of introduced Gudam, and then Molly actually kind of didn't feel too awkward about it because Gudam was all cheery and seemed very genuine to meet her. It's funny, there's kind of a lot of animosity it seems like she has towards the Covenant races, but it's almost like when she's in that moment of introducing herself to some of these characters that it's not as... or she overcomes that really well. Even if she's just putting up a facade, she overcomes it.
Well, I mean, she's... what she sees is that Gudam is not really that threatening.
She's a very pleasant and cheerful grunt. And I really like the personality that Matt gives Gudam, because it's a very kind of chatty, upbeat personality. And it just fits really well, I think, with a grunt.
Yeah, you gotta hear how they voice, how she is voiced.
Is it? Does it sound like a grunt? A child female grunt?
Yeah, it's not Joe Staten quality grunt, but it's pretty good.
Well, that's good. I like that they put that kind of little touch on there.
They do a real good job. She's the babble mouth. She's the one that just won't shut up.
I think that is also a little bit disarming to Molly, too.
You know, she's not shy. She just, you know, she's not afraid to talk to anybody.
Which sometimes that's, I guess, what you need. Have someone else be outgoing to initiate, and then it doesn't feel as awkward to respond. So later on in, I don't know if it was the same day or maybe a couple days later, there was a dispute or kind of a fight breaking out in the schoolyard.
Nope. This was the same day. This is all same on day. Her first day of school.
Talk about a rough day of school. They're out, I guess, kind of during what would be their recess. And some bullies actually go over and push Bakar and start picking with him. They start trying to fight with him, and he just kind of takes the hits. And eventually, Kareem and Dural go to try to stop the bullies from beating up on Bakar.
Actually, what happens is Gadam goes over there and stands between Bakar and the bullies, which I can't think of his name right now, and in her cheery voice says, "Oh, his name's Carl. Hi, Carl. How you doing?" And it startles him, and he freaks out, and he pops her across the mouth and knocks her over, knocking her breathing mask off. And then Kareem comes over to assist Gadam, and that leaves Molly over by herself, and she's, you know, debating on whether or not she wants to go over there because she doesn't, you know, she doesn't like bullies. Who does? And eventually she goes over there, and the fight ensues. The one thing you get from this is Bakar, he's not a pacifist, but he does not believe in fighting when he doesn't have to. So just to kind of give you an idea what, you know, why these three boys are picking on an elite and the elite's not absolutely tearing their butts apart, you know why.
And that's kind of the foreshadowing I was talking about in Lessons Learned. When the few Marines that were coming off of the shuttle were throwing verbal insults towards Kashaw, you just have these bullies doing the same thing to Bakar. It was kind of a nice tie-in. They all get suspended for a week. Molly actually enjoys the time of isolation to herself. And eventually has to be convinced to come back to school by Tom and Lucy, only under the guise of they would be teaching her some self-defense. So they were pleased that she stood up, because eventually she stood up for Bakar and the other two, right? She kind of...
Well, Bakar and Gadam, yeah.
Right, because of... who was it? Carl being the bully. So Tom and Lucy were going to teach her self-defense under the one stipulation that she would come back to school. And when she got back, it turns out that not only she was being taught to self-defense, but Bakar, Kareem, and Gadam were also there as well. So it was the four of them. That didn't go over too well at first.
No.
But eventually they got used to it. And eventually they warmed up to each other, and eventually they became all best friends.
Yeah, after almost dying.
Yeah, nothing like near-death experiences multiple times to make friends out of each other. Yeah, so back to the incursion from Dural. They're attacking the repository. The kids are there. Kashaw is telling them to go into the transport that they came in on. And it was Bakar that recognized what's the name of the beast again?
Rathakreet.
So Bakar recognizes that the Beast is a Rothacrete, which he's heard from Tails. And at first, he was trying to tell Kashaw that that's what it was. And Kashaw's like, you know, those were just fables and tales and
stories to keep children in line. Sure.
Yeah. And then he's like, no, look at it. And she takes a few seconds like, wow, you're right. And that's where they kind of develop a tactic to start making really high pitched loud noises. So she's actually
the way this works is supposedly according to the fable, if you whistle, it will scare it away. Keep this in mind. So what does Kashaw do? She lets out this ear splitting whistle. By the way, this whole time while this little discussion is going on, the Rothacrete is chasing Mike Spencer around the vehicles.
And he's dodging every which way.
Yeah, he's hiding behind vehicles and stuff, trying to not get squished or ate. But Kashaw, she basically moves away from the children and the transport and whistles very loudly to get the thing's attention. And it charges after her. At the same time, Dural is hiding behind vehicles or moving between vehicles with his cloak, observing what's going on, trying to find the engineer. They're trying to find...
Well, he has a team that's actually all finding an engineer, and he's actually watching the stuff going on. And this is where he actually recognizes Bakar as his brother, which is...
Asim.
Yeah, Asim Ndama. And he's can't believe it that one of his family members would betray the Covenant and ally himself with the humans. So before he does anything rash, which he's about to, he actually gets a report from some of the other people that came with him saying that they found the Huragok, but it's been locked away. Because apparently protocol is if something ensues, secure the Huragoks first and then take care of the threat. Good thing that was in place. Because it definitely came beneficial to that. While Kashaw was trying to distract the Rothacrete, was it kind of an accident at first, or was it something that Ghadam just did because Kashaw was about to get attacked and she let out a high screech of her own?
That was because she was scared.
Yeah, so the Rothacrete starts coming after them.
Well, no. The first thing, the quartetted children, they see the Rothacrete chasing Kashaw. Kashaw narrowly avoids getting eaten by this animal. And when that happens, Ghadam squeaks. As that's happening, Ghadam squeaks and distracts the Rothacrete, basically gets it to turn its head. And it misses Kashaw. Then they come up with a brilliant idea to get Ghadam to squeak again. And the idea is to run the animal back and forth between Kashaw and the kids. So what they do, you know, they take off running away from the building and Ghadam squeals again. And then the Rothacrete comes chasing them. And it turns out Molly is the slowest one. So just as the Rothacrete is about to pounce on Molly, there's this other ear-splitting whistle, and Kashaw has basically called the animal back to her, and it, you know, basically plants its feet, turns around, and goes chasing after her.
This is one giant tug of war.
Yeah. By this time, Mike Spencer has actually gotten a goshawk fired up, and has brought it outside and gotten it into position. And as the Rothacrete is charging Kashaw, he starts unloading Gauss rounds into it.
And it takes, what, two shots to actually knock it out, and then he puts another three in for good measure?
I think he puts more than that in it. You know, the way they described it, this was the Halo 2 Goshawk that they were using.
Yeah, the one that fired really quickly.
Yeah, the one that, you know, it fired as fast as you could pull the trigger.
It wasn't quite that fast, but it was still pretty quick. I think it was one slug every like 0.8 or 0.9 seconds.
I don't think I ever found myself waiting for a cooldown on that Goshawk.
It definitely wasn't as long as a second, but it was pretty close. You launching up MCC? I don't think... Yeah, it wasn't as fast as you could pull the trigger. I know that much.
Were there any multiplayer maps that had a Goshawk on them?
What's the tram one? Terminal? Terminal had Goshawk on it.
It did?
Oh, yeah. Pretty sure. Pretty sure, yeah.
MCC. It's all the way over there.
Infefe. Confefe?
Let's just find out. But anyway, on to the book.
Yeah. Laird's teasing us in the chat, by the way.
Imagine that. Laird teasing? At least he's here, not just lurking.
He was here at the beginning of the show. So
he lurks during game nights.
Well, there's that too. So while the Wrath of Crete is mercilessly killed by Mike Spencer, Pelican actually comes in for support because it was radioed in probably by Kashar or one of the other teachers there. And they happen to come in on the backside of the repository where they see Dural's troops actually going back into the portal. And no one else really knows about this until later on, where they get the brief of, hey, this actually happened. There were other elites there that probably used the Wrath of Crete as a distraction, and they had video footage that they went back and confirmed. And I think this is also where, when they were in Kasha's office after the incident, where they revealed that one of the elites was Dural. Asim's brother was actually the one that was leading. Asim was the one that was leading the charge, and that's where he revealed to the others what his real identity was.
So, big surprise.
Yeah. Did not see that coming, honestly, which was nice. Molly definitely felt a little awkward after that. I think Gadam and Kareem were a little more understanding and a little more forgiving of the fact that just because someone in his family was leading a Covenant sect that was kind of trying to keep the Covenant alive doesn't mean that he was that way. And Bakar was trying to explain that that part of my family is dead to me. That's not who I am. I'm different from them. From here, there's more reports of Guardians activating, and was it kind of after this point where the Cortana message came into play? Or I know it's close to here. It's kind of in between here and when that message comes in, when the Guardian activates and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's right about in this area.
At some point during the night, if you remember in Halo 5 where Cortana is making her wide broadcast basically to the galaxy. Well, every electronic component that had a speaker was playing this message from Cortana, and everyone at Onyx, at Paxopolis, heard this message from Cortana. And then shortly thereafter, the Guardian activated, which has to be equally scary.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know I'm jumping over a lot of details here. Is there anything that we should be filling in that you can think of?
Well, during this time frame, Asha overhears another conversation that she's not supposed to.
Says it about Sinaion.
No. That her parents actually showed her on purpose. But no, she overheard another conversation between, I think it was Mendez and her parents. There's a few weeks that pass in here because, they go through several weeks of training before the Cortana message plays. So, there's nothing like story breaking or anything like that. They basically just kind of still get to know each other. Molly's pumping Lucy and Tom for information, things like that. The servants of the abiding truth are fortifying their citadel and trying to find a way to attack the humans. And then, you know, pretty much, you know, that's really all that goes on in that particular point. Once Cortana's message plays, then the next day is when the Guardian wakes up while all the students are at school. Because Carl and his buddies come up to Bakar and try to blame the Sangeli for the threat that Cortana made.
Oh, yeah, the message.
And, you know, they're basically just, you know, they're looking for a fight.
And this is one of a few times where Molly is using her snooping knowledge to basically spoil to everyone else that probably shouldn't know of what's actually going on. Because I doubt anyone else that was living there probably knew about Cortana being a rampant AI and controlling the Guardians.
Yeah, while they're at school, the Guardian becomes active.
And that's when this, you hear the Guardian song and it generates all the EMPs, waves. And the UNSC scrambled pretty quickly to get some of the ships up in the air to try to attack it. There were ships from Trevelyan that were launching. I think there were a few different armaments from Paxopolis that were launching, but
yeah, they had Hornets, Pelicans, light aircraft attacking it, as well as a frigate. Apparently, you can get a frigate off the ground pretty quick, but the Guardian does its little EMP pulse and knocks everything out of the sky, which does fall on Paxopolis. Well, Trevelyan at this point. You know, while the UNSC is fighting the Guardian and the soldiers, they call them armatures, but we know them as soldiers, the servants of the Abiding Truth notice the commotion and decide that it's time to attack.
Time to use the opportunity.
And they, instead of attacking the military forces, they decide to attack the civilian forces, or the civilians around Paxopolis while the military is trying to defeat, or, you know, defend against the soldiers. While this is going on, Dural and his elite team, Dural spots the, the Hurgok, prone to drift, flying above the buildings, headed somewhere, and they see an opportunity to capture him again. So him and this elite force, probably, I'm guessing 10 or 15 elites.
That's what I was thinking.
That's kind of what it sounds like. They don't actually ever give a number. Take off after this Hurgok while the rest of the force, you know, does what they're doing.
They're just slaughtering every human they can find without reason. And that was, their objective was to basically dissuade the researchers and the Oni and UNSC military when they're done fighting to leave Onyx and maybe be destroyed to stop their research. And of course, being only in UNSC, all they're doing is going to be just disrupting the beehive, especially when it's Oni.
Yeah, it's a mess. But during this time, Tom spots this group of Sangeli chasing Prone to Drift, and he follows them. Prone to Drift is on his way to go to the school, performing his normal duties,
which so happens to be class time for teaching the four kids their training. Which,
no, that's earlier when Tom and Lucy have to go out on a mission, and this is where they discover that somebody's been using the portals.
Right, but this was the same. I thought I remember reading in here that the reason that he was coming to the school at that particular time there was it was the same time where he needed to fill in the time slot because Tom and Lucy weren't there.
No, that is it. That was the time that he's normally there to do maintenance.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. I confused that with
the reason he brought them the message for the training is because he was going there anyway, because it was, you have to do his daily work on the school.
Okay.
And he wanted to meet them.
That's, I don't know. That's right.
But anyway.
A Hargok with feelings?
Yeah.
Emotions? Yeah. So yeah, he was there.
Protogriff is going to the school.
And who's on the roof?
During this whole mess, Bakar, Molly, Gadam, and the other guy had snuck out of the lunchroom and are now on the roof looking at the Guardian. And lo and behold, guess who comes floating down? Prone to Drift.
Like, hi, guys. And
I noticed that the sensors said that there was somebody on the roof, so I decided to come over and investigate. Yeah, typical Hargok, you know. But they discuss ways that they may be able to disable the Guardian. And this is something that I had not known about. Hargok, they store ancestral memory. Kind of like we store stuff on a hard drive. You know, it's like they have an internal storage drive that they access to, you know, retrieve ancestral memory, which was really kind of odd, just the way they said it.
It was cool to see, because that was kind of a new aspect of the Halo universe that we haven't seen yet as far as the engineers go, I think. Because, I mean, a lot of the other stuff we could have kind of established through the past novels already, but that was kind of like the, oh, this is an interesting little quirk to the universe. Well, that was kind of that stuck out to me.
The way it was always put before, I mean, yeah, they pass knowledge from one to the other as they create them. But I always thought, you know, it was active in their mind. I didn't realize it was like stored somewhere, you know, to be accessed as needed.
Eric Yabu is ruining our funny. He's saying it's not really new.
Well, I don't care, Eric Yabu. It's the first time I've heard anything about it.
But yeah, it's interesting because I think Molly or one of the kids were saying, well, is there a way to disable the Guardian? And he's like, well, I can ask my, I guess, previous memory or whatever. And then, like, within 6 seconds, he's like, oh, yeah, there's this thing that I can do that if I go up within his, within a certain broadcast range, I could probably disable certain parts of him.
And, so you know, then they discuss on how they're going to get close enough to it. And then Prone decide or pipes up with, well, I can enclose Onyx in a slip space bubble. Ah, well, where do you need to go to do that? Well, I can do that from the school's control room.
I can do that downstairs.
And during this time is when Dural shows up at the school.
And Carl got what he deserved.
He breaks into the cafeteria and basically holds the students hostage. He kills Carl. Of course, Carl was being an idiot anyway, but we'll just leave that there. He does shoot Kasha, but she survives. But he's there. He wants the Hargok, and he's holding them hostage to get the Hargok. And in the commotion, Bakar goes into the lunchroom, hoping to kind of offer himself up to get the Sangheili to leave, or get Dural and his soldiers to leave, but finds that Dural doesn't really care about him. And this is where the rest of the school finds out that Bakar is actually Asim Umdama. And then they kill one more boy they shoot one more boy. Don't know if they actually killed him.
They don't. They say later on that he's actually going to be able to pull through. When they were talking about when Kasha got shot and one of the other teachers. But yeah, he was just injured. He actually comes through.
Prone to Drift turns himself over. And at about this time, Tom shows up and starts killing the elites that are outside on guard duty. One of them comes running in and tells them what's going on. They leave. And, you know, of course, they threaten to kill Bakar and if the Spartan doesn't let him leave. So the chase ensues. Well, Molly, Gadam, and what's the boy's name again?
Kareem.
Kareem decide that they need to follow Tom because they need to help Tom, the Spartan. So they chase after him, and this all goes back.
Well, not quite.
Huh?
Not, they don't. They actually don't chase right after him right away. They go into the schoolyard for some reason, then they see Dural and Bakar and Prone to Drift running in another direction.
No.
I don't think they chase after him right away, do they?
Yes. Yes, they do. They start off after Tom, and of course, Tom can outpace them, so he pulls away from him. They basically hang back far enough to where they can keep an eye on the servants and try to stay out of Tom's line of sight, but they see Tom change direction, and then they see the servants have changed direction as well.
Gotcha, okay.
Anyway, the servants go back to the repository to use the portal there because they figure out that they can't make it through with the Hergok to the portal they came from because of all the fighting. So they figure they'll take the long way home. Tom gets to the repository first, cuts them off. Big fight. Tom gets hurt to the point where he's incapacitated. Molly and the crew decide that they're going to chase after the servants. So they all pick up a weapon. They go through the portal and follow them. And they come up with a pretty interesting way to save Bakar by getting another animal to charge the servants.
Through a really risky roundabout way.
Yeah. This is another house-sized cat-like creature that was stalking Molly and her crew. But they get, that distracts the Sangili. Bakar gets away after one of the Sangheili betray Dural and basically break his knee.
I didn't write down his name, but...
Yeah, I can't think of his name either. Just as that happens, Lucy shows up in a Pelican. She's been off on a search mission trying to find the servants. While traveling, Prone to Drift had been sending her coordinates through his translation pad that he keeps attached to his belly.
I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, I would think that, they would be able to come up with, just a little pin or something they could wear around their neck to do that.
Well, so
I just
even
found
Kiel, even Kiel has his little...
Has a collar, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's just odd that, this Forerunner Hergok has this tablet stuck to its bottom. So Lucy comes in and rescues the three kids, and then she goes after Prone to Drift, which she takes out a few of the servants, but she winds up getting hurt pretty badly, and the kids help take out the rest of the servants with the chain gun on the Pelican, because Kareem
knows how to fly.
Spends a lot of time in flight simulators. So they come up with a plan that they're going to fly back to the Guardian because they're running out of time. So they fly back to the Guardian. As they're approaching, it's starting to come back to life. Initially, its defense mechanisms come online first, which basically what happens is anytime they try to approach, it has some kind of wave that just pushes them away.
Yeah, it's like a shunt.
Yeah. So they get the brilliant idea to dive bomb the Guardian.
Yep.
They're in the process of this, and Prone to Drift says, "You don't have to do this.
I'll just float on in." Da, 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 da.
They're like, "Well, we probably should have consulted with him before we did this." But they're like,
"They made it out. They're fine."
"No, you can't. You'll die." And Prone says, "I can float." I just thought that was funnier. But they distract the Guardian long enough for Prone to Drift to get inside and disable the gravitics.
Yeah, that was an interesting term to see.
Yeah. So basically, the Guardian falls apart.
Not before it actually does regain its offensive weapon and does issue out an EMP blast. When they saw the Guardian was charging it up, they were nosediving to the ground, actually towards Trevelyan as quickly as possible. And he actually pulled the nose up of the Pelican just enough to where they kind of bottomed out a little bit. And then the pulse came, but since they were already low enough to the ground, they were actually just skid on what looked like a tarmac that was in front of Trevelyan. So they actually were just kind of jostled around and not being taken out of the sky.
Yeah, they crashed, but they didn't crash from 50 feet, not 2 miles.
Everyone lived happily ever after.
Overall, it's a really good book. I mean, the first chapter, you really feel
gut-wrenched.
Yeah, for Molly. Just the way it's portrayed, you feel her lose everything.
Yeah, just completely devastated. Like, I don't think there's been a more intricate description of a glassing event throughout the rest of the Halo fiction than what was done in this first chapter of the book. It was pretty devastating and heart-wrenching to read it. Great start to a book.
Yeah.
I kind of half-heartedly say that jokingly, but also serious, where it's like it's actually a great start to a book. Because it kind of sets the tone for Molly and just kind of her transformation of absolutely hating the Covenant because of what she went through as a child, and then overcoming the barriers of, okay, these aliens that I'm living with now, those races are responsible, but these specific individuals were not. Kind of just overcoming that stereotype. Eric was saying, being able to understand the way they felt.
And they did a really good job of portraying what it would be like to be on a planet during a Covenant glassing.
Yeah, they really did. We did actually miss the last chapter of the book, where even Keel discovered there was a Forerunner ship on the third planet from the star that there was an active portal on. So we haven't seen the last of Servants of the Abiding Truth yet. They may have been cut down as far as their numbers, but there is another avenue for them, and that's where the book ends.
And Dural did survive and is still the leader of the Abiding Truth.
He came in after everything kind of settled. I think the book said it was 3 days that he was wandering, and he came back into the camp, and whoever the guy was that knocked out his knee, he went up to it and just assassinated.
Cut his head off. Yeah. He made a point with his sword. Oh.
I see what you did there. And yeah, he took over the kind of the role of leading the servants. And that's when even Keel said, well, I found something that may be able to continue your efforts. And this is something I'm kind of curious about. And I don't know if you've had this question either, or if it's explained in another book that I haven't gotten to yet. But if the Hurrigok are Forerunner made entities, wouldn't they realize that the humans are the inheritors of the Forerunners, and why would they work against humans?
Well, you have to remember that the Hurrigok have been enslaved by the Covenant for eons. They have been bred into that, so it's part of their genetic memory. And their main focus, you know, their main thing is they don't care who they work for. You know, their thing is they repair stuff. That's what they do. They're not political. I mean, and even in some of the comments that Prone to Drift makes, you know, you hear like, why should I stop the Guardian? It's not going to affect, it doesn't affect me at all. You know,
that's a good point.
Influenced by Molly and her friends on what Prone to Drift does. You know, they're pretty much, you know, indifferent to who they work for, as long as you're not destroying Forerunner items. you know, when you destroy Forerunner items, then they get upset because their whole purpose is to fix it. You know, their whole purpose is to maintain those Forerunner items.
Well, wouldn't they be happy because then they have something to fix? I'm kidding. I just thought it was funny.
Well, but fix is right. One thing, you know. Fixing it when it's broke is one thing. When you destroy it, then that's beyond.
That's true. Yeah, so there's a ancient Forerunner ship on one of the planets, and there's a portal that actually leads there. So that's where they're headed. So I'm assuming we'll see a book that picks up on that down the road.
Or a game.
Yeah, I could see it tying in with Halo 6 with everything else that we saw closely related to Halo 5 in the book. I could see that.
Yeah.
I wonder if the fact of Prone to Drift being able to disable that Guardian is going to play a part in Halo 6.
I don't see how, but...
I don't either, but it's just kind of one of those questions of, well, they found out a way to disarm one.
Yeah, well, you have to encase them in a slip base enclosure, but to do that, you have to be in there with it to disable it.
I don't know.
I mean, it does mean that they're not invulnerable.
Right, you just have to get under their skin.
I mean, if you can get through their defenses, you can shut them down. Well, at least the Hurgok can.
Right. The Hurgok knows how. Well, Prone to Drift knows how because one of his ancestors knew how to. Quick, Prone, make more yourself. All right. Well, that's it for the book. Not sure what book we're doing next time, but we'll figure it out at some point. A couple of community things to wrap up. There's a new loot crate that's out. The next theme is Arena. It's all multiplayer themed, and there is a Warzone related t-shirt that's going to be in there as well. That's available for order up through April 15th at midnight Eastern Time, 9 p.m. Pacific. And you can head on over to podtegler.com/lootcrate and then use podtegler at checkout to save $3 off your crate. So if you're into the multiplayer aspect of Halo, this crate might be the crate for you. Definitely go check it out. The Halo 3 throwback playlist is live. There was the community update that got posted during our podcast. We'll probably get to it next week since we're kind of running along on this show anyways. But there are some new maps that have been included into the classic playlist. There is Narrows, Epitaph, Construct, Foundry, and Assembly. The returning maps are Guardian, Boundless, The Pit, Citadel, Isolation, High Ground, and Ghost Town. So those are all the maps that are going to be in the Halo 3 throwback playlist. I hope to get in there a little bit this weekend. But I think the one that I'm looking forward to the most out of the new ones that they're bringing in is probably, you would have to say, even though I kind of didn't like it in the original, but Narrows.
Narrows is a lot of fun.
There's a lot of Halo 3 I just didn't like because of the aiming mechanics. But Narrows is a good competitive map. And I also like Construct too. It has enough variety in there to have it be a lot of fun. Epitaph was kind of a weird one.
Yeah, but Epitaph is a lot of fun. Especially if you can snag the rocket launcher or the hammer.
Yeah. The Epitaph was one of those where I didn't get it when the game first came out, but it grew on me over time. I'm guessing, depending on how many people will come tomorrow, that you may play it during Fragment Friday.
I'll probably start off in it.
That'd be cool. I will not be there tomorrow because I am going to go see the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra in concert for Harry Potter.
Oh, fun.
So the next week I should be around. But yeah, so make sure you check out our Fragment Fridays tomorrow with GT starting at 8:30 Eastern Time, 5:30 Pacific. Make sure you check us out on Sunday, where I will be streaming again with Bobby for another campaign run on Legendary in Halo Wars 2. We'll be doing Operation Spearbreaker, hopefully getting both done. And then that might be the last one that Bobby can co-stream with. We'll see how long he has the ability to co-stream. If not, he should have enough bandwidth where he's moving to, or the new internet provider he's getting to, at least co-op, but it's going to be just whether or not he'll be able to. Anyways, so that's Sundays around 10 p.m. Eastern time. And then, of course, our podcast on Thursdays at 9 p.m. Eastern time. So check us out during those streaming schedules. You can also check us out on our social media platforms. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, Twitch, Mixer. We have our Xbox Club, and we have our Spartan Company. They can check us out with. GT, when do you have an approximate time frame on when you're doing the next Achieving Halo video? I think you have two more left, right?
Yeah, I've got two left, and it looks like March the 10th, 8 p.m., if I can get some people together, we'll do it then.
Cool. I have to see if I'm available. Might jump in. I know you mentioned you wanted to get me in on the very last one, but if you need another person, I might be able to jump in.
Yeah, this one, we get to kill two wardens simultaneously.
Yikes. And are we doing it on legendary or heroic?
Of assuming course. Legendary. Because there's another achievement to complete the level on legendary without your entire fire team dying.
I have a feeling there's going to be a lot of starts revert to last checkpoints.
No, on that one, the revert to last checkpoint doesn't work.
Oh.
Once it registers a complete wipe, it disables the achievement.
So I guess it's going to be making sure no one goes down. Could you go back to last checkpoint before someone goes from going down to dead?
Well, once the last person gets down, that automatically wipes you. Now, if you go back to last checkpoint before the last person goes down, then that will keep you from, recording the loss or recording the wipe.
I mean, like if someone's down, but you can't get to them and they die, I'm assuming that kills the achievement too, right?
No, it's the entire fire team. In other words, everybody has to die to disable the achievement.
Oh, okay.
So that's as long as everybody doesn't die, then we're fine. But Understood. Getting through it on legendary with four people without anybody actually dying, as long as you stay close together, shouldn't be a problem.
Gotcha. Okay.
You know, the only hardest part is in the warden room.
Okay.
But if you're quick enough, then it's not too bad. And there's plenty of heavy weapon, and somebody suggested trying to do twin assassinations, but I'm pretty sure that's not going to happen.
I guess if you could balance the fire delivered to two wardens at the same time, maybe you could.
I just wish there was a little bit better indication of the warden's health. You know, like on the knights, you have pieces that fall off to where you can kind of gauge what kind of health the knight is in. The warden, it's really hard to
tell.
Yeah, it's really hard to tell.
I agree with you.
If you're interested, shoot me a message on Xbox Live at Godzilla T, or you can hit me up on Twitter at Godzilla Todd. Just leave me your gamer tag, and we'll get you in.
Very nice. An update on our Spartan Company. We did manage to get one of our level 4s up, so forget to pay the toll. We got up to level 5, so thanks everyone for putting in the work to get that done. I tried in Big Team. I did not contribute a single kill. We do have 6 out of, now it's 1,020 that we have to get of that. We do have one level 5 that is really, really, really close to being done. To kill enemy Spartan with ground pounds, we need 9 more to complete that commendation. Just 9. I put a challenge out there to see if people would get that one done by the time the podcast was done tonight. And no one's contributed to it since then, because I was going to give away something. So no giveaway tonight.
I didn't realize we were that close, right? I've been working on them.
Yeah, I tweeted out 30 minutes before we started, and Bobby was trying to get it. I don't know what playlist you were in, Bobby, but like in Slayers and stuff, I could usually get a ground pound maybe once per game. And SWAT can be a little difficult. Depending on it, for SWAT, it really depends on what map you're on. If you're on Fathom, you'll get it.
Or Eden, or the other version.
Empire.
Empire. Well, yeah. I played two games on Eden and SWAT tonight, and I actually had some opportunities where I could have got ground pounds, but I didn't take them because I knew I'd die.
We still have the Pain Train and Sorry Mate to get as well. For the Pain Train, we have another 266 to go. That's the Shoulder Bash one, and then Sorry Mate, which is Kill Marines. We have another 2,383 to go. Still need to kill lots and lots and lots of Marines. But that's where we stand on commendations. So you can head on over to our Spartan company, podtacular.com/company. We'll take you there. We do have, I think, a slot remaining, but we do need to kind of clean it out a little bit. We might go ahead and clean out some of the roster. Feel free to jump on over into the Spartan company, and we will gladly accept you. Make sure you check out the podcast network. We're part of a network of gaming-specific shows such as Critzcast, Podcast 76, Guardian Radio, The Learning Cliff, Work in Progress, and How to Murder Time. You can check all of them out over at thepodcast.com. Thanks for tuning in to us live via Mixer tonight, or for those who download us via podcast aggregator, whether it's iTunes or Google Podcasts, or I think we are actually on Spotify Podcasts now. I think I got an email about that we're actually posted on there. I haven't gone in and checked, but I think we're up there now. Also on TuneIn, which is the Amazon specific one, but we've tried to get the podcast listed on all the major podcast feed sites. So if there's a place where we're not listed, then let us know and we'll do some investigation to get our podcast there. Otherwise, that's it for our stream tonight. Not sure what our next book will be, but we'll have a decision here within the next couple of weeks. We're going to be taking this month off since I'm going to be getting married. But we will be back in the hot seat next week for another fun-filled episode of the show. So until next time, keep on fragging portals.